Hi everyone, welcome to Baby Steps Nutrition, a podcast that focuses on nutrition, health, and wellness for families of children of all ages and stages. I'm your host, Argavan Neil-Forouche, a pediatric dietitian and mom of two young children. My goal is to bring you impactful information that you can apply every day in a simplified, practical form to make life easier. Now let's get into today's conversation. Grief and loss can occur in many ways, whether an end to something such as death or breakup in a relationship, or a disruption in one's life, such as moving or divorce. Children and adolescents experience a wide variety of losses throughout their lives. As parents and caregivers, we may feel particularly helpless in trying to help our child. We may be processing our own emotions and are confused what to say and how to act. Is there a fine line between protecting our children and being honest with them? Dr. James Ironman is an integrative holistic psychiatrist who is based in San Francisco, California. In addition to his private practice, he holds many positions, including Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at University of California, San Francisco, Adjunct Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Touro University in Vallejo, California, and Staff Psychiatrist at Napa State Hospital in Napa, California, just to name a few. Dr. Ironman uses a combination of medication, psychotherapy, and integrative holistic medicine, encompassing both Eastern and Western healing modalities. Dr. Ironman, it is an honor to have you here on the Baby Steps Nutrition Podcast. A warm welcome to you.
Thank you, Ardavan. I'm glad to be here. One thing I did think of, I would add to that lovely introduction you did for me, is I do consult at Lahaim Schools, which is a program in the East Bay. I've been a consultant there for the last 20 years. And in the past, I ran a children's home in St. Louis for 20 years at Epworth Children's Home as medical director there. Didn't run it as an consultant. I also started a child clinic for the Archdiocese of St. Louis. It was supposed to be a partial hospital program, but it just wound up being a clinic. And I've also run two adolescent eating disorder programs. One is a consultant for the Lutheran Hospital in St. Louis, and one I was the director of a freestanding equine therapy eating disorder unit in Crystal City, Missouri.
Thank you for sharing all that. There's no better person to speak on the topic than you. Something that I had thought about quite a bit are the pandemic happened. And of course, sadly, so many people were dealing with grief and loss. And of course, people had been dealing with that prior to that. But it really got me to think about, we know how adults deal with it and adults communicate their feelings. But I always thought about the children and what they're going through and what they're thinking and how they process grief. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on to really share your knowledge and expertise, because we know that children are not just little adults. But could you talk to the listeners about the manifestations of grief and loss in children and adolescents?
Well, the study of children and depression and grief and loss in a systematic scientific sense started sort of in the mid-70s. Before that, the approach was very psychoanalytic, Anna Freud, all of which I think has some value to it, but it wasn't systematically studied in terms of what actually happens in populations of kids. And the pre-ads are somewhat different than the adolescents. As you get older in adolescence, they tend to react to grief and loss in some ways similar to adults. It gets more similar as time goes on. However, in adolescence, there's often a lot of negative behavior as a result of being depressed or having significant loss in the family, whether it's loss of friends, changing schools, losing their support network, losing a parent, losing a significant relationship. These things happen a lot. Many adolescents go through periods of significant depression, even if they only last for 2 weeks. However, most of them go through, when they have a depression, it may last, the majority of them, like maybe 75%, will have significant depression with major mood and behavioral manifestations, similar to adults, in that they lose their appetite or they eat too much. They have trouble sleeping or they sleep too much. They get very anxious or they become rigid and act like they're not bothered. If they have an attentional disorder, it gets aggravated. They may indulge in more antisocial behavior. In fact, antisocial personality traits sort of start in adolescence and may indeed start secondary to depression. Mm-hmm. Untreated depression, untreated severe depression due to great loss and anger about that. The older one gets as an adolescent, the more similar the depression appears to be. The younger one gets, it appears much different. So from pre-ads to, say, mid-adolescence, the tendency to withdraw, mm-hmm. tendency to do poorly in school, the tendency to isolate, the tendency to be irritable or grumpy or lose interest in the life around them increases dramatically when they have a significant loss and they're getting depressed. When you back up further into pre-adolescence, the mourning of loss is significant. Mourning the loss of, say, a parent, mourning the loss of schoolmates, which is happening at this plague, actually, we're experiencing.
Yes.
We call it a pandemic, but this is previous centuries they would have called it a plague. Mm-hmm. And it's very scary for children. They're not allowed to go to school. When they do, they have to wear masks. When there's all kinds of controversy about wearing masks or not wearing masks, and they're caught in the middle of this, society is a little bit crazy this way. It's not very reassuring. Many of them feel very sad. Sometimes they indulge in eating too much, gaining weight. Sometimes they indulge in withdrawal or not eating. That can get quite serious quickly. They can be quite oppositional and throw temper tantrums. So when we talk about loss, our entire culture is going through a huge loss with this pandemic. We don't know when it's going to be done with new variants coming up, if it will ever be done. Mm-hmm. So our entire culture is mourning the lack of our previous lifestyle, and our children are very scared about their future. Mm-hmm. Not only do we have a pandemic, but we have global warming, which is no longer a fantasy of some future date. It's happening now. And what kind of world will they grow up into?
And what are your thoughts when people say children are resilient? I think they're more referring to dismissing children's feelings because they'll outgrow it or they'll get over it or they'll forget about it. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, that's called being a Pollyanna. That's very soothing for the adults to think that the children are resilient and they'll bounce back. But the children are suffering. Mm-hmm. These are real losses. They don't see their playmates. Getting together on the playground hasn't been available to them for a long time. Now, some children are doing it with masks on, but it's not the way it used to be. They've lost their old lifestyle, their old freedom, their old ability to enjoy themselves and be children. Mm-hmm. Yes, resilience occurs. This happens in adults as well as children, but the losses do take their toll. Mm-hmm. And they're serious losses and serious tolls. And just like children who are refugees from wars, children of this pandemic are refugees from this plague. Their worries and their concerns need to be taken quite seriously. Mm-hmm. And listened to and supported. Before 12, probably mostly play therapy and things like this, having opportunity to express their feelings to their parents is very, very important. After 12, some more conventional forms of therapy of actually talking to a therapist, sharing your feelings, maybe doing creative arts therapy and things like that are good for pre-ads as well as ads. But many children are in pain and they're scared. And nothing they're seeing is reassuring them at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. And now in regards to therapy, there are so many different approaches. You yourself use a variety of them with your patients. Can you please tell the listeners about what are some of those techniques and approaches that you use?
I think we mentioned play therapy earlier. Play therapy is helpful for kids. Actually, play enactments are helpful for adolescents, and where they take roles and they do type of psychodrama type of thing with other kids. Ritualized practices such as creative arts therapy, where people draw not just one drawing, but a series of drawings to see how the energy changes, or they dance, or they sing, or they play music, or they do things like therapies called sand tray, where they play in the sand and build different scenarios with figures from a collection of small play figures is important. They can work out their fantasies that way. Having children keep track of their dreams, and while they may or may not discuss them in terms of symbology, especially as pre-ed, they can act them out. They can be the lion they're afraid of, or the angry principal, or they can identify the energies and role play them out and let them go through them and be less intimidated by them.
Mm-hmm.
Same in adolescence. Actually, that will apply to adolescents and adults, although adolescents are perfectly capable of more abstract therapies. They can do cognitive therapies. They're used to doing that type of thing because they're in school.
Yes.
And most cognitive therapy is actually designed for college students. And that's where most of the therapy is done. But they're used to doing that. And it's very simple. And it works pretty well,
mm-hmm.
at least as well as the antidepressants like fluoxetine and Prozac. And actually combining the two works better than either one. Neither one are that effective, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. If you combine the two, then there's some, you move the clinical bar a little more to being clinically effective. But there are other therapies. I mentioned equine therapy for girls with eating disorders. You know, it's a matter of wills, right? So often there's a control issue for girls with eating disorders. And the horses are highly tuned to those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes very apparent what's going on quite readily. The idea of doing diets and herbs and non-pharmaceutical approaches, I think, is very helpful for kids because they don't like to be seen as taking a pill. It symbolizes that there's something sick and wrong with them.
Yes.
So there are varieties of Ayurvedic treatments, which can be employed with diet and some physical treatments, body treatments, and symbolic treatments, approaches to help process and balance things out, which amazingly, children are often open to. They also like the idea of taking herbs versus drugs. In Ayurveda, we do something called pulse diagnosis, like they do in Chinese traditional medicine, TCM, traditional Chinese medicine. And the pulses, it's also used in Tibet medicine, and the Bonpo, and it actually was used in Europe a long time ago, although that's fallen away. But the pulses in the body will indicate the imbalances of the energy with regard to frustration, with regard to being ungrounded, with regard to whether their heart is broken or whether they're happy again. All that's apparent in pulse diagnosis. Lots more is apparent in pulse diagnosis, but we're talking psychiatry. Traditional Chinese healers who are good at pulse diagnosis can tell a lot about the entire family from the pulse of the child, even back to the grandparents. So the whole family system comes out. And in Ayurveda, we utilize not only the ordinary physical presentation in the body and things, but we also recognize various time values. So Ayurveda has to do not only with the physical body and the emotional body, but also energy body. Mm-hmm. And that's apparent in terms of Jyotish, or the universe as you at the time you were born. And those considerations also have remedies that can be addressed, which are often very simple, either through herbs or through clothing or through mantra therapy or through ritualized therapy or through using various special remedies, which aren't available in this country but can be obtained through India, mm-hmm. of essences of various gems and metals like that. Mm-hmm. And all these approaches can help balance the energy in the child, and also can demonstrate what the imbalance is in the family. That can be addressed through these subtle approaches as well.
And do you like to use a combination, or do you like to start with one and then move on to another? Or does it differ for every patient?
There's several models in psychiatry. There are models in medicine. We talk about science as if it's a body of knowledge, but science is actually a method of hypothesis testing, mm-hmm. and it progresses by discarding old hypotheses. So old models are discarded when they don't stand up to the testing, or new models come up which are more heuristic and explain things better. And so medicine progresses by scientific testing, and you may not know, but 80% of all medical articles in all fields are found to be faulty and discarded after 10 years, although often the therapies that are associated with them don't disappear for about 20 years. So the idea of a model may seem a little theoretical, but that's actually, we're often dealing with a biochemical model of how things work. Germ theory is a model. Mm-hmm. Virus is a model. There are other models that have to do with, in Chinese medicine, various forms of yin and yang. In Ayurveda, various forms of vata, pitta, and kapha energy. Mm-hmm. All of these models have a database to support them. And indeed, Nature published recent articles in the past 6 months about many Western medical doctors would have thought was placebo effects using needles in Chinese medicine. It's actually connected to nerves, which we hadn't identified before, that go into the fascia and distinctly alter the blood flow and the tone of the muscles and immune responses that are connected to all these tissues. So in psychiatry, there are another set of models. One is the biochemical model or biological model. So if someone has ADHD, it's felt that they have an attentional problem and that their dopamine systems are not helping them focus well enough, and we give stimulants. Mm-hmm. And that's well and good. It helps. It makes a huge difference. Or if someone's depressed, we may have a neurohormonal model of various transmitters needing. Initially, we used to thought that there was a deficit of serotonin. There is no such thing. There is no serotonin deficit. But when either serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine are stimulated, then there's a definite improvement in the activity of the forebrain and the emotional brain, amygdala and hippocampus, different parts of the temporal lobe, septum, things that is apparent from these biochemical interventions. That can also be done electrically, mm-hmm. with transcranial stimulation. It can also be done by changing the BDNF through exercise. And actually, the best antidepressant is cardiovascular exercise over 35 minutes.
Yes.
So jogging, essentially. It's twice as effective as Prozac, and it's about 50% more effective than, say, dual agent antidepressants or stimulant antidepressants. And it's more effective than the most effective medical treatment, which is electroshock for depression, mm-hmm. which appears to work by refreshing the brain and helping the astrocytes and the glia and things like that through increasing the blood flow by about 300% during the shock therapy. It really doesn't work by erasing memories. Anyway, there are these I'm getting to the point of there's these different models. There's also the psychological model. So we've talked about loss, talked about isolation, we've talked about anxiety, fears, and these all can shape our behavior and our well-being. Sort of like a chair has four legs. So if you pull the biological leg, you'll get a change in the feeling of anxieties or depression. You pull the leg related to anxieties, these anxiety management techniques or meditation techniques, or have expressive therapy techniques that get rid of anxiety, then you get a reduction in the physiology of anxiety and depression. Then we have another model, which is family social. Also, the dream work. I should mention that dream work is extremely helpful in the psychological model. And we're coming up to a new era of psychedelic therapies, which are far more effective for PTSD and depression and anxiety than any of our previous treatments. Although, quite frankly, dream work is exactly the same. Mm. If you know who Stan Grof is, he's the quote, godfather of LSD psychotherapy. He says essentially dreams, psychedelic states are synonymous. Psychedelics are just a way of getting to the unconscious, which dreams are telling us about. Mm. So dream work is very similar. And the psychedelic therapies are coming. We have ketamine already, the psilocybin and the MDMA for PTSD are being investigated in multiple countries and getting and approved. Some are approved in Israel already, mm-hmm. Should be approved in the States shortly, in Canada shortly. But this also relates to the family social model. Another leg of the chair is the family social model. So what goes on with your peers, goes on with school, how you relate to your teachers, what happens in your community, what happens inside your family and extended family, it's all part of the same cat's cradle. You pull any one of those fingers and the whole makeup changes.
Yes.
So doing therapy with the family per se, decreasing expressed emotions, increasing intimacy or time, or decreasing interactions, all make a huge difference. And there's plenty of data to support that, although it's not supported by the insurance companies much these days, but it certainly is appropriate when you're treating children.
Yes.
Then the fourth model is psychospiritual. And when we say psychospiritual, most people in the medical world get nervous, but quite frankly, it's the most common treatment for addictions. It's the only treatment that's effective. So the 12-step program is effective 50% of the time, which is about 10 times more effective than any other addiction treatment. There's a self-selection bias, but there's a self-selection bias in all the treatments for addictions. And the interesting thing about the addictions issue is it doesn't matter what kind of counseling you have with regard to your spirituality. You can have psycho-spiritual counselors at all the rehab centers, and it's of absolutely no value. They found no benefit. However, one spiritual experience shifts the bar entirely. The 12-step program has always said that until you actually hit bottom and have a experience of your, quote, higher power or spiritual self, you won't recover. Mm-hmm. You keep going this way and relapse after relapse until you finally do. And this can be short-circuited by inducing spiritual experiences. I use something called holotropic breathwork, which is a non-drug psychedelic therapy. And when we think of psychedelic therapies as something new, but they've actually been going on for thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. The oldest lineage of humanity are the sand people of the Kalahari Desert. And they've been doing trance dance with breath and recording it on the caves, like in rock art, like in Lascaux, you know, the various cave art of Europe and Spain and in the deserts of Africa. towards experiences of 18 to 20,000 years ago are older. Some debate about some of the art being 80,000 years old in Africa. I believe there's some caves that are 40,000 years old. And these weren't done with psychedelics. They were done with breath.
Right.
And you can get in the same states of psychedelic consciousness, non-ordinary states of consciousness, through ritual and breathing, dance and repetitive movement, and a shaman's drum. They've been doing this for a long time. And the Australian, you know, Bushmen, shaman wizards of the upper Amazon, the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert, have been doing this for tens of thousands of years, perhaps 100,000 years or more. They may have done it 250,000 years ago before the Ice Ages. Mm-hmm. As they helped, they may indeed have been part of the group that was hiding out at the south tip of Africa during the Ice Ages, southern tip of Africa. This is a bit speculative, but there are four, what I'm trying to point out is there are four different models in psychiatry. There are multiple models in medicine, and it's not all talked about in the New England Journal, although apparently Nature is starting to talk about it. And psychedelic therapies have made it to the New England Journal and been discussed there and published there since the 1990s, actually. There's been a renaissance. It's just taken this long to get various pharmaceutical companies and approvals from the FDA and the NIMH and things like that to get this ball rolling again after the sort of inquisition we had in the 60s, shutting all these things down. And children, I've done holotropic breath work with 14-year-olds, 16-year-olds, 18-year-olds, 12-year-olds. It hasn't been so successful with 8-year-olds.
Oh, but, I see. So the youngest about 14 or 12.
They've had good experiences. I've written up the 14 and 16-year-olds for having excellent experiences. Long-term abstinence after one holotropic breathwork. He did have a higher power experience, which I think blew him away. But these things happen all the time in this kind of breathwork or other kinds of breathwork and our psychedelic therapies or psycho-spiritual therapies. So meditation techniques, mantra techniques, breathing techniques from whatever tradition. And the Catholic Church has contemplative outreach, which is as a potent meditation form. There's mindfulness techniques, which have been wrested away from Buddhism and are now taught more secularly, but can also be taught in a Buddhist framework. The various chanting techniques and mantra techniques and repetitive rosary techniques, both in the Catholic Church and Hinduism and Islam and Sufi dancing, things like that. All of this works. So the idea that there's a pill for this that'll work is a nice idea, but there are many other approaches. Children don't have to be subjected to pills. Maybe the pills are in order. Maybe they do need a mood stabilizer. Maybe they do need an antipsychotic medication to ground them from being so aggressive, along with their attentional medicines and anti-ADHD medications. Maybe they do need an antidepressant that's effective, more effective than Prozac, to help them along with therapy and cognitive behavioral techniques. Maybe they do need family interventions, get the parents to have a different view of the control of their children.
Right.
So that they can allow the child to grow into their own control, especially between the ages of 14 and 16. One of my favorite therapies is to tell the parents, I want Charlie here, your 15 or 16-year-old, to develop their own rules.
Mm-hmm.
And they often drop their jaws. What? I want the kids to write out their own rules with their own consequences, right? Natural consequences or not natural consequences, whatever they are. And you go over them with them to make sure they're not conning themselves. You get to help enforce them with. They're the ones that develop the rules because actually they're the ones in charge anyway.
Right.
You want them to grow up to be in charge. So why don't we start with, and take you out of the equation? So you're just a coach. Sometimes the kids won't do that, but most of the time they will. They relish having the power given to them. And they often sober up dramatically when they know the consequence they dreamed up will work.
Right. It's powerful. Some of these techniques that you mentioned, you have done YouTube videos on them, and I would love to link those in the show notes for the listeners if they'd like to get more information.
Thank you. Yes, that's better than me trying to explain them all, because really we could talk for hours about any one of these particular approaches we've talked about, or the problems we're talking about.
For sure. And so we have focused a lot on the children, and we also have a lot of caregivers that are listening. They're experiencing profound grief themselves. What advice would you offer them when they're so overwhelmed with the heavy burden of helping others like their children, but they're trying to stay afloat themselves?
Don't do it alone. Mm-hmm. Get help. Joni Mitchell has a song where she says, two heads are better than one. It's absolutely true. One of the biggest problems we have in our culture is the nuclear family. Mm-hmm. So you don't have grandma and grandpa and aunts and uncles all living under the same roof. In several generations, and can give their own input or their own restraint on what's going down between the parents and the kids, or between the kids. So get help, open up, talk to therapists, talk to your ministers. The people that do most therapy in the United States are the ministers, the men and women of the cloth, right? They do more therapy by far than any psychiatrist, psychologist, or social worker and therapist. People resource with them more readily, and go for whatever resources you have. Talk to people. Talk to your friends. Talk to your neighbors. Talk to your priest or rabbi or minister. Talk to your groups at church. Talk to your groups at the PTAs. Get professional help. If that's not enough, there's plenty of stuff on. There's plenty of YouTubes online discussing various problems, what they are, and possible ways of dealing with it. It's good to resource that. If you go in for professional therapy or some clinic, be sure to check out the therapy in terms of what kind of track record they have, mm-hmm. what's the data to support it, what's the pros and cons. When you go in for a therapist, check to see what kind of reviews they have online, what kind of standing they have and background. And it's also, we haven't talked about bibliotherapy, but actually there are a number of self-help books that can indeed improve the parenting skills, social skills, interpersonal relationship skills that you can download readily. There are currently apps as well. I haven't found apps to be particularly great so far, but I'm sure they'll get better over time. So there are cognitive behavioral apps you can download and interact with on a systematic basis. Take advantage of anything you can take advantage of. One of the most healing things people can do for their family is to have outdoor family time, especially in the Bay Area. You know, nature itself is quite a healer. In Japan, actually, they have forest therapy.
Yes.
And their doctors trained in forest therapy to take people out into the forest for several hours at a time, and they get reimbursed for it. The insurance is paid for it. We're not quite that savvy yet in the United States. Our healthcare system limps along pretty poorly.
Yes.
But there are lots of things you can do, and especially things that where the family's enjoying themselves, where kids have fun, where the adults have fun.
Yes.
Where they have fun together, playing games, you know, swimming, surfing, hiking, playing ball. All these things are extremely healing, ritualistic, and bonding. Mm-hmm. One thing all human beings need, whether they're adults or children, is bonding.
And meaningful connection.
Yes, meaningful connections. Personal emotional periods of unique intimacy, mm-hmm. which aren't shared by other folks. It's nothing against the warriors or the giants or football giants or baseball giants, but it's not a large thing. It's with the family. Mm-hmm. And or perhaps just with one or two parents or a grandparent or a cousin. These things give a substantial amount of basic well-being to build your life on. Sense of connectedness, sense of groundedness.
Belonging. Yes.
Yes. In the United States, we don't generally have long family histories on our walls. Mm-hmm. Other cultures, you might know who your 14th grandfather or grandmother was. Turns out that that 14th or 16th grandfather or grandmother actually are affecting you today from the in your DNA, mm-hmm. in terms of epigenetics and methylated DNA. So their stresses, you're still dealing with.
Yes.
So we don't have those family histories. We need to develop that for some sense of connectedness and the history of the past and where you know where you're going better if you know where you've been.
Mm.
And it's a cultural thing. So the United States as a rule could use a little more of that.
Mm. Such incredible advice, Dr. Armin. And on that, I really want to thank you for speaking on such an extremely difficult but necessary conversation with me and the listeners.
This was a pleasure. I hope that the individuals that listen to this find some value in it.
Yes.
And that they and their children will be happier.
Yes. And as you mentioned, through support and open conversations, the healing process, whatever that may look like for the individual, can hopefully begin when they're ready.
For the individual and
the unit,
the family system. Yes.
Yes.
And our social system.
Yes.
There's a community, there's a neighborhood, there's a school. All of this is extremely important.
Yes.
So the other thing that we did leave out is talking with school counselors, et cetera, is important.
Yes, that's a big one.
Okay.
Yes. So much value there. Thank you so much. And to the listeners, thank you for tuning in. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Baby Steps Nutrition Podcast with your host, Argavan Neelforush. We hope you enjoyed our deep dive into all the tips and tricks you and your family can use to make daily life a little easier. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, share with others, and follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Baby Steps Nutrition Podcast. As always, you can head over to babystepsnutrition.com to sign up for our email list, as well as check out all the links and resources in the show notes. See you next time. Tune in. Feel great.